Hello, and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. Today's show features articles from both the October 20th and November 3rd editions of People Magazine and the Fall 2025 edition of Women's Health. Some of the articles that I'll be sharing today include Reba, I love this chapter in my life, Elizabeth Taylor, I always was a rebel, and Cheese, the healthy era. Reba, I love this chapter in my life. With two TV shows, a major music milestone, and a doting fiancé by her side, the country icon has found her happy place. By Daniela Avila, photographs by John Russo. This is a People magazine exclusive. The world knows Reba McEntire as the charismatic country icon and sitcom queen. But to her family, she's just the red-headed rodeo cowgirl from McAlester, Oklahoma. My sister Alice, for Christmas one year, gave me a toilet seat cover. On the top of the toilet seat, it said, "The Twinkle." To let me know I'm not a star, I'm a twinkle. Keeps me grounded. McEntire, 70, quips, cracking up the video crew at her People cover shoot in the Hollywood Hills. That modest mindset and sense of humor has served McEntire well for her 5 decades in the showbiz. But contrary to her lavatory decor's message, she's had a stellar career. Since signing her first record deal in 1975, McEntire has sold more than 75 million albums, scored 24 number one country hits, and earned 3 Grammys. She made a successful transition to acting with her early aughts comedy, Reba. Now she's starring on 2 NBC shows this fall, season 28 of The Voice and season 2 of her feel-good sitcom, Happy's Place, returning November 7th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Says McEntire, "I think I'm happier now than I've been in my life." Melissa Peterman, McEntire's longtime friend and co-star, can vouch for that. She is at peace with who she is. That kind of inner happiness just exudes on the outside. The star, who is mom to son Shelby Blackstock, 35, with ex Narvel Blackstock, has found as much joy in her personal life with her fiancé and Happy's Place co-star Rex Lynn, 68. The pair met filming 1991's The Gambler Returns, The Luck of the Draw, and reconnected 29 years later. Last December, Lynn popped the question. Getting to work with Rex, drive to work with Rex and do the show, the rehearsals, drive home, talk about it, rehearse together. That's what's really special for me, she says. I've not had that before. Now with her fiancé by her side, McEntire says she's living in the moment. Anybody that ever asks me for advice, I'll say, enjoy every minute. This is your 4th season as a coach on The Voice. What keeps you coming back? I think part of me is very, very curious as to how many more great contestants can they find. They find the best people. I am blown away every season. Then, of course, the other coaches. My relationship with Michael Bublé goes back a ways. We met at Muhammad Ali's Celebrity Fight Night in 2007, and he is a good buddy. Niall Horan could be my little brother. He's cute, he's funny, he's witty. And Snoop Dogg comes up with these sayings and things to entertain us. What I love about the three that I'm with, we say our prayer before we go in. Snoop instigated that. Happy's Place is coming back for season 2. You've gotten to reconnect with so many old friends from Reba on that show. What was that like? Getting to work with Joanna Garcia Swisher again, she played her daughter on Reba, is just like there's not been a day between the last time I got to work with her. And having Melissa Peterman on the show and Rex Lynn, we are a tight-knit family, an acting team, and we have so much fun together. It's natural. Anytime I get to step on that set, I feel like home. It's my happy place. Your castmates have spoken out about how cute you and Rex are on set. Is that intentional time spent together? It happens naturally. On the set, we'll belly up to the bar and have our breakfast. He is so funny. Whatever I have, he'll have. So if I have my oatmeal, he'll have oatmeal. And then I always have to have a donut hole because I've got a sweet tooth. You two accidentally revealed you were engaged on the red carpet at the Emmys in September. Tell us about the proposal. We got engaged on December 24th, Christmas Eve, at Leipers Fork in Tennessee. We were going to make the announcement when we got back to LA in January and the fires happened. It wasn't appropriate. The time never presented itself until the Emmys, when it just happened. How did you feel when he proposed? Lovely. It was a total surprise. I was thrilled to death. He's very romantic. I asked him, well, when do you want to do this? He said, let's have fun with the engagement time. So we haven't set a date or anything. We're just enjoying each other. What kind of romantic gestures does he do for you? He loves to hug, and he tells me he loves me an awful lot. I've never been loved by a man like Rex Lynn. Rex is a very tender-hearted man, and I just love him with all my heart. He's a good guy, real bashful, though. Just the chemistry between Rex and me, and then having so much fun on Happy's Place. We're just having a blast, loving life, and loving getting to work together. You've gone through 2 divorces. Do you have any advice for someone who may be experiencing heartbreak? Oh, never give up. If you're in heartbreak right now, just take care of yourself, take care of your heart, and then be open with it. I was not looking for love at all. So it just happened at the right time, right place. God's timing is everything. This year, you also experienced loss with the death of your stepson, Brandon Blackstock. He was the ex-husband of her friend Kelly Clarkson. How will you remember him? My relationship with my stepson, Brandon Blackstock, was precious. I absolutely loved that child. He came into my life, I guess he was 4 years old. Then when Narvel and I got married, he was 13, 14. Along with his mom and dad, I helped raise him along with stepkids Shauna and Chastity, and they were my kids. Brandon is truly missed with his mischievousness and his love of life. He brought joy to everyone that met him and will never forget him. This year marks the 50th anniversary of when you signed your first record deal. Does that blow your mind? I didn't realize it was 50 years. Time flies when you're having fun, but wow, I still see where I was signing the contract 50 years ago. It took from 75 to 83 to have a number one record. with Can't Even Get the Blues. But I had no idea about the music business. I was a rodeo cowgirl. I was a rancher's daughter and a rodeo brat. To get into the music business was scary, leaving all my friends and my family, but I had great people that guided me. That was the thing I got out of this whole career, my friends. Did your career turn out the way you expected it to when you were starting out? No, I had no idea what to expect. See, I thought when you got a record label to sign you and you had a record on the radio, well, you get a tour bus and you're rich. My first tour bus was years later, and it broke down every day. Before that, I was in vans and pickup trucks with campers and horse trailers to haul the gear and stuff. My imagination wasn't big enough to even create what I've gotten to do in my career. I'm so grateful God put me in this position. And hopefully, my music has helped people with their lives and kind of have a buddy to talk to about their problems through a song. Music is so healing, and I'm so glad I get to be a part of that. You turned 70 this year. What's your mindset going into this new decade? Shocked. When I was 18, 20, our oldest cousin, Doris Jane, hit 30, and we thought, oh, well, she's going to die. Here we all are, living in our 70s and 80s, and we're all healthy and happy. It's amazing. It's wonderful being 70 and getting to do what I get to do at the level I want to do it. So it's keeping a positive attitude moving forward. Don't take a minute for granted. Quit living for tomorrow and for yesterday. The hardest lesson I've ever tried to learn is to be still and live in the moment. That's really hard to do, but it's so rewarding when it clicks. When did it click for you? Well, it's only happened a couple of times. I'm still working on it. It's kind of like learning how to meditate. Oh my gosh, that's almost impossible for me. I've got these meditation tapes that I listen to. It's hard. What's your secret for staying happy and healthy? I stretch consistently every morning. Rex and I do try to eat as good as you can. I love a good 8-9 hour sleep. And my buddy has gotten me back walking again. 2 or 3 miles is good for me. I'm like a horse that's ready to go back to the barn when we're heading to the house. Do you see yourself retiring or slowing down anytime soon? I do, but I don't know when. It could be in 20 years. I think I'll know when it's the time. Dolly Parton and I talked about that an awful lot when she did the Reba show. And I said, "Are you going to retire?" She said, "Why should I? What in the world could I do and have as much fun as what I'm doing in this job right now?" I agree with her 100%. Slow down maybe, but no plans of retiring. How would you describe this chapter in your life? Deliriously happy, content. I used to think being content was a no-no, because if you're content, you're not going to strive to continue to do better. That's not true, because you always try to improve your health. I love this chapter in my life. I'm very grateful. You've been listening to a People Magazine exclusive, Reba, I Love This Chapter in My Life. Elizabeth Taylor, I Was Always a Rebel. Her beauty was incandescent, her diamonds were worth millions, and her spirit was untamable. A new docuseries shows why today's stars idolize her. By Liz McNeil and Gillian Telling, This is from People magazine. When Chris Wilding first listened to Taylor Swift's Elizabeth Taylor track number 2 on her new album, The Life of a Showgirl, he found it especially magical. Wilding, the 70-year-old son of the late actress and her second husband, Michael Wilding, was delighted to hear Swift name-checking his mom's Violet Eyes, Portofino and the Plaza Athene, two of her most favorite romantic haunts, and White Diamonds, her signature scent. Taylor and mom do seem like kindred spirits, he says. They were both the very embodiment of female empowerment. Taylor was a force so fierce that even 14 years after her death at age 79, the Oscar winner remains a touchstone for a new generation of stars. Kim Kardashian has produced a new 3-part docuseries, Elizabeth Taylor, Rebel Superstar, now streaming on Fox Nation, featuring unheard interview tapes of the provocative beauty who lived life so unapologetically that when her extramarital affair with Richard Burton caused the Vatican to denounce her erotic vagrancy in 1962, she just charged right ahead, a trail of paparazzi, Louis Vuitton luggage, and small dogs behind her. Kardashian calls her such a fighter, a woman who is as candid about her addiction to alcohol and pills as she was about her close calls with death. She once called her premature obituaries the best reviews I ever had. More than breaking the rules, she made up her own. 8 marriages to 7 different men, a then unprecedented $1 million salary for 1963's Cleopatra. She negotiated with the studio from her bathtub. And her trailblazing crusade on behalf of people with AIDS. As she puts it, "I don't think I'm reckless, but I am fearless." Read on for more secrets about the star and her own words about her extraordinary life. "What do you expect me to do? Sleep alone? A scandalous love triangle." Within months after Taylor's third husband, Mike Todd, died in 1958, she sought comfort in the arms of singer-actor Eddie Fisher, then married to Debbie Reynolds. But not for long. Fisher left Reynolds, with whom he had 2 kids, and moved into Taylor's house. He and Reynolds divorced on May 12, 1959. Hours later, he married Taylor. As Reynolds and Fisher's son Todd Fisher say in Rebel Superstar, "The uproar made the fuss over Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt look like a walk in the park." Eddie Fisher later wrote that he was powerless against Taylor's allure. "Elizabeth lived by her own rule. She wants what she wants when she wants it." The betrayal wounded Reynolds, but she came to terms with it. "He wanted her, so he left," said Reynolds. "He was the selfish one. Love blinds all." The two women reconciled after Taylor left Fisher for Richard Burton and apologized. "I don't know why I did it, and I certainly was wrong. But look what I have now." A woman of few regrets, she told Larry King she had only one. "I'm sorry if I ever hurt anyone. That's all." It was so intense, it was almost abnormal. Her romance with Richard Burton. The two met on the set of Cleopatra in 1961. Burton was so hungover, she recalled, he asked me to hold a coffee cup up to his lips, and I was gone. The first on-screen kiss lasted so long that director Joseph Mankiewicz finally asked, "Does it interest you that it's time for lunch?" Over the next 15 years, they married and divorced twice. Tumultuous, yes, but never boring. Burton described her as an eternal one-night stand. Their chemistry, we were like two atom bombs, she said, was legendary, full of booze, brawls, and trips to Bulgari, and everlasting. 3 years after his death, in 1984, at age 58, she wrote him a letter. "You so pervade my thoughts and my very inner mood that it's like you are in me. I have you, but holy God, I don't." Big girls need diamonds. Elizabeth's treasure trove. Taylor once said that her obsession with jewelry began as a baby when she opened her eyes and the first thing she saw was an engagement ring. "I was hooked." When she died in 2011, her collection, including a 19th century diamond tiara from husband Mike Todd and the 33.19 carat Krupp diamond from Burton, sold for more than $137 million. She had sold the 69.42 carat Taylor Burton diamond, a gift for her 40th birthday, and used some of the proceeds to build a hospital in Botswana. In 1969, Burton presented her with La Peregrina, one of the largest pear-shaped pearls in existence. Within hours, it was lost in their Las Vegas hotel suite. "We all got down on our hands and knees looking for it on the white carpet," recalls her friend Vicky Teal. "The dog was chewing on it. Somebody polished it up, but you could still see the teeth marks." "For the first time in my life, I wasn't being exploited by anyone. The star goes to rehab." In 1983, Taylor checked into the Betty Ford Center for Alcohol and Prescription Drug Addiction. In Rebel Superstar, her son, Christopher Wilding, recalls, "She had physical ailments. When she was little, we had all these miracle drugs and you took a pill. That was her approach. Better living through science. But things got to the point where it was decided an intervention would be necessary." The next day, Taylor went for treatment. "It was like being slapped in the face with reality," she said. She did chores and shared a room. "I felt, really, for the first time in my life, that I wasn't being exploited by anyone," noted Taylor, who was candid at a time when celebrities rarely discussed addiction. "I was being accepted for myself. I had been forced to look at the honest truth of who I was." We're all effing God's children. Her pioneering AIDS activism. "I always loved my life, the parties, the jewelry, the men. But that was just a warm-up," said Taylor. The star's final act wasn't about herself. In 1985, the year she lost her dear friend, actor Rock Hudson, to AIDS, she co-founded AMFAR, the American Foundation for AIDS Research. 6 years later, she established the Elizabeth Taylor AIDS Foundation, focusing on helping the most marginalized people affected by HIV and AIDS. Amid the 80s climate of dread and hysteria, she recalled, "I thought to myself, bitch, do something yourself." The first high-profile celebrity to rally legislators in D.C., she fought for research funding and helped persuade President Ronald Reagan to finally acknowledge the epidemic after his deafening silence. She visited hospices and AIDS wards, gently asking patients what they wanted most. They all said physical contact, somebody to put their arms around us, she recalled. Through her foundation, which to date has awarded more than $40 million to support those in need, her son Christopher says her tireless work carries on. If people want to hear something from me, okay, it's not going to be about how to apply lipstick. Living her life her way. When told she was 3 inches too short to star in National Velvet, her breakout role, Taylor, then 12, ate steak for breakfast and rode her horse for 5 hours a day. Miraculously, she grew 3 inches in 3 months. I was always a rebel, she once said, and rebel she did. At 15, she stood up to the all-powerful Louis B. Mayer, the co-founder of MGM, after he swore at her mother, who was acting as her manager. She told him, "You and your studio can both go to hell." As her son Christopher says, she was never cowed by the establishment, whether it criticized or condemned her lifestyle, which was often. She remained a force to be reckoned with, much akin, he says, to the hot pink Elizabeth Taylor Rose named in her honor in 1986. He grows them in his garden. "I laugh about that damn rose every time I have to prune it," he says. "Their color is so arresting, it seems unreal. Their scent is mysterious and makes your head spin. But lean in too close and the thorns will snag you." As he reflects, "Her time in the spotlight is now over, but I hope that who my mom was as a person and the fearless life she led will continue to inspire generations to come." This has been Elizabeth Taylor, I Was Always a Rebel, from People Magazine. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer broadcaster, Kelly Pyle, and this is the Women's Hour. Bruce Springsteen's Secret Side, a new biopic, pulls back the curtain on a dark period of the boss's life and serves up the biggest challenge for Jeremy Allen White since he broke out on The Bear, by Tommy McArdle from People. When most people hear Bruce Springsteen's name, they likely think of at least a few things: his nickname, The Boss, his beloved home state, New Jersey, and hits like Born to Run and Dancing in the Dark. The 76-year-old rock star is, as Springsteen Deliver Me From Nowhere writer and director Scott Cooper says, the soul of America. But the man who wrote seismic anthems like Born in the USA also offers a tender, more vulnerable side to his signature storytelling. That's the facet of the artist that Cooper, 55, explores in his new biopic starring The Bear's Jeremy Allen White. Set in 1981 and 1982, a very personal moment in my life, Springsteen has said, the film zeroes in on a burned-out young Springsteen grappling with depression and holing up at a rented farmhouse in the Garden State after touring for his hit 1980 album, The River. Seeking a more stripped-down sound, a major departure from his first 5 studio albums, Springsteen wrote and recorded songs like Atlantic City and Johnny 99, using just a harmonica and acoustic guitar, forming what ultimately became his dark and daring album, Nebraska. White, 34, first got a front row seat to his source material at a Springsteen show packed with 90,000 fans in London. He invited me into his dressing room just about a half an hour before he went on, recalls the actor. I was so struck by his honesty right from the beginning. The boss went deep. During the emotionally fraught period depicted in the film, White's Springsteen reckons with his difficult childhood and lingering tension with his father, Doug, portrayed by Stephen Graham, who struggled with his mental health and alcohol use. The musician even experiences a panic attack in one pivotal sequence as he fights with his record label over his new sound. I had a pretty good breakdown back when I was 32, Springsteen recently told the Awards Chatter podcast. My family was filled with mental illness, my aunts, my uncles, my pop, and it was just in our blood, so I had to deal with it too. He has said he thought about suicide and told Time that therapy was a total life changer. Cooper had one goal for two-time Emmy winner White as he pivoted from playing a tortured chef on TV to a rock god. I said, "You're not playing Bruce Springsteen, the global icon. You're not playing the myth. We're stripping all that," says the director. White continued to meet with Springsteen, whom he grew up listening to in Brooklyn, throughout production. "He's always been right on the other end of the phone," White notes. Still, White felt far from a rock star when he began preparing for the role. The actor picked up a guitar for the first time just 7 months before he began filming. "I didn't understand how my fingers were supposed to behave. It was a very humbling start," White says. That's also White's real voice in the film. "Working with a vocal coach, we got into trying to get closer to Bruce's voice," he says. "Then there's certain songs where there was nothing that it could have prepared me, you know? I remember recording Born in the USA and losing my voice for a couple days." Springsteen's longtime producer and friend, John Landau, now 78, was also actively involved in making the film, which depicts the pair's strong bond. Succession's Jeremy Strong plays Landau, who works to keep Springsteen afloat during the musician's dark period. You look at pictures of Bruce and John in those early days with their arms around each other and the smile on their faces, and you can feel the love and the connection between them, says Strong, 46. On-set personal bonds also grew in the face of tragedy. During the first week of production, the director's father died and his house burned to the ground in the Los Angeles wildfires. Springsteen sprang to action. "He moved my family into his home when our house burned," says Cooper. "My daughter Stella, who was learning guitar when her guitar burned, Bruce promptly sent her one of his. That's who Bruce Springsteen is." Ultimately, what arrived on screen is an anti-biopic, as Springsteen has called Deliver Me From Nowhere. Says Cooper, "I suppose there'll be people who would have preferred that I made a film leading up to Born to Run, or a more jukebox musical, a film with all the hits. But rather, it's an intimate look at a moment when the boss had to retreat to avoid surrender. Instead of chasing the roar of arenas and chasing number one hits, he chose silence," says the director. "A four-track recorder and a rented bedroom. and the courage to look inward and write what I think is a masterpiece. Springsteen, who has long been pursued by filmmakers to put his story on screen, seems to relish defying biopic expectations. It just takes a couple years. When I went through some just difficult places in my life, he told the crowd at the Telluride Film Festival, and I'm old, and I don't give an F what I do now. The boss on the big screen, stage presence. Jeremy Allen White worked with a vocal coach and at first thought there was no way he could learn to play guitar like Springsteen. His right-hand man. Springsteen joked, Jeremy Strong plays a much better looking version of his longtime producer and friend, John Lando. A legendary club. The film recreates Springsteen's history at the Stone Pony, a venue in Asbury Park, New Jersey, the icon frequented early in his career. Bruce's life now. The rock star has been married to his Jersey girl, Patty Scialfa, a member of the E Street Band, since 1991. They met in the early 1980s after the events of the biopic. Caught dreaming, Scialfa 72 captioned this 2022 Instagram photo. His expanding family, Springsteen and Scialfa with their children Evan, 35, Samuel, 31, and Jessica, 33, in 2018. They welcomed a granddaughter, Lily, in 2022. You have been listening to Bruce Springsteen's Secret Side from People Magazine. Prince William gets personal. In a rare TV appearance, the Prince of Wales opens up like never before about his wife's cancer journey, raising their children, and his vision for change when he becomes king. By Aaron Hill with Simon Perry, this is from People Magazine. In the cozy warmth of a Windsor pub on a drizzly February day, over the clink of glasses and the low hum of conversation, Prince William leans back and confides, I think it's safe to say that change is on my agenda, change for good. It's an unprecedented glimpse into the mind of the future king, a man shaped by loss, duty, and a fierce desire to shield his children from the pressures of royal life. Across from him, actor Eugene Levy, host of Apple TV Plus's The Reluctant Traveler, listens intently as history and humanity collide. The prince is speaking as both heir to the throne and a father determined to do things differently. It was a savvy move by William, royal biographer Sally Bedell Smith says. By choosing a Canadian comedian as his interlocutor, William seemed to be signaling that he wanted to break out of the conventional mold. In some ways, it's a quiet reintroduction, a chance to reframe the Prince of Wales' public image after years of headlines surrounding family rifts and the fallout from the departure of Prince Harry and Meghan, Duchess of Sussex, from the royal fold. It's also a chance to put Windsor, his home for the past 3 years, front and center. William and Princess Kate will soon move to Forest Lodge on the Windsor Castle estate, a forever home, even after he becomes king. In the October 3rd episode of Levy's travel series, William, 43, leads Levy, 78, on a rare tour of the nearly 1,000-year-old castle. But amid the grandeur, William opens up about the challenges that have shadowed his life, including Kate's and King Charles's cancer diagnosis. Worry or stress around the family side of things does overwhelm me quite a bit, he admits, because it's more personal. It's more about feeling. It's more about upsetting the rhythm. As he walks through the grounds where he and Kate are raising their children, Prince George, 12, Princess Charlotte, 10, and Prince Louis, 7, William confides, 2024 was the hardest year that I've ever had. Life is sent to test us, and it definitely can be challenging at times. I'm so proud of my wife and my father for how they've handled all of last year. Asked about their health, Kate, 43, revealed she is in remission for an undisclosed cancer in January, while 76-year-old Charles's cancer treatment continues. William offers a rare update. Things are good. Everything is progressing in the right way, which is all good news. He also offers a glimpse into the couple's home life. For me, the most important thing in my life is family, he says. If you don't start the children off now with a happy, healthy, stable home, I feel you're setting them up for a bit of a hard time. That means dinner around the table most evenings. We sit and chat. It's really important, William shares. None of our children have any phones, which we're very strict about. He reveals the siblings each navigated Kate's diagnosis in their own way. Everyone has their own coping mechanisms for these sorts of things, and children are constantly learning and adapting, he says. We try to make sure we give them the security and the safety that they need. And we're a very open family, so we talk about things that bother us and things that trouble us. Coping with pain as a child is something William knows all too well after the tumultuous marriage of his parents, Princess Diana and Charles. You have to have that warmth, that feeling of safety, security, love, he reflects. That all has to be there. And that was certainly part of my childhood. My parents got divorced when I was young, so that lasted a short period of time. But you take that and you learn from it and you try and make sure you don't make the same mistakes as your parents. His brother Harry is notably mentioned only once in a brief callback to the media frenzy that surrounded their childhood. I hope we don't go back to some of the practices in the past that Harry and I had to grow up in, William tells Levy, and I'll do everything I can to make sure we don't regress in that situation. That he never again references his brother or sister-in-law speaks volumes. They are clearly part of the past, notes historian Robert Lacey, author of Battle of Brothers. Levy, for his part, says no subjects were off limits, not even Harry and Meghan. I was not told I couldn't ask anything, he told reporters, but I had no interest in asking. It's a very delicate issue. Adds royal biographer Andrew Morton, author of Winston and the Windsors, if you want the prince to talk openly, you avoid asking about his brother. Still, William's willingness to reflect so personally marks a striking break from the royal family's old way of operating by ostriching, as Bedell Smith puts it, avoiding discussions of emotional problems in hopes that they would go away. This delicate balance between tradition and progress is where William's vision for the monarchy comes into sharp focus. "I enjoy change. I don't fear it," he says. "That's the bit that excites me, the idea of being able to bring some change. I want to question things more. Are we still doing and having the most impact we could be having? If you're not careful, history can be a real weight and an anchor around you, and you can feel suffocated by it. I think it's important to live for the here and now." "For royal watchers, the striking admission is fascinating," says Morton. "The two words, change and monarchy, do not naturally go together. Monarchy is about continuity. To predicate your future life on the change you're going to make to it, well, that's a delicate mechanism." For William, though, change doesn't mean upheaval, but rather modernization, a monarchy more emotionally attuned and grounded in everyday life. Prince William's been quite vocal about what he wants to do when the time comes, says a source with ties to the palace, to be more accessible, more approachable. And he's not thinking only of his own reign. "I want to create a world in which my son is proud of what we do," he says of young George, "a world and a job that actually does impact people's lives for the better." As the tour draws to a close, William emerges not just as heir to the throne, but as a father and husband trying to redefine it. "He struck me as one of those lads," says Morton, "that's different from previous generations. He seems very much one of us, even though he is the future king." And that may be the point. Between pints of cider and the echo of centuries-old walls, William shows a monarchy that feels more human, and a monarch in waiting, intent on keeping it that way. Learning from the past. When asked about giving his kids a relatively normal home life, William says his own experience of that definitely began with his late mother, Princess Diana, but was cut short by his parents' divorce. "I think that's the first time he walked up to those difficulties of those years," says Bettel Smith. William unplugged, a lighter side of the future king. Cheers to his college days. "Do you know how many pubs we had at St. Andrews?" 45. "The mission was to get around all in one go. None of my lot managed it. It's quite a feat." "Real talk. I was a big fan of your earlier films, Eugene. All the American Pies. I'm afraid I was. I was of that generation. I watched with lots of my friends." Spilling tea. "When there was nothing else going on at Eton College, I'd come around and have a bit of tea with Queen Elizabeth because she had the best teas ever." Getting schooled. "I probably need some history lessons. George, my son, is way better in history than I am. I have to check with him now on my dates." Off-duty life. Sleep. When you've got three small children growing up and they're waking up at all sorts in the night, it is quite exhausting, as every parent will tell you. This has been Prince William Gets Personal from People Magazine. Cheese, the health era. An all-out, super fun celebration of one of the world's most misunderstood superfoods. Photographs by Julia Gartland from Women's Health. Wait, why is Women's Health doing something on cheese? Hunks of cheese, to be exact? There is, after all, lots of guilt by association. Cheese covers our nachos, blankets our delivery pizza, dusts our puffs. This kind of cheese isn't great for you, even if it is delicious, and it's not even really cheese. Shelf-stable queso, industrial mozzarella, powderized poof sprinkle, you should probably avoid these ultra-processed cheese posers or only enjoy them every once in a while. But then there's real cheese, which is actually great for you. One chunk is all you need, cave-aged Gruyere. Fresh and tangy Chèvre, a wedge of gloriously stinky blue. This stuff, this real cheese, has tons of muscle-building protein, bone-strengthening calcium, gut-healthy probiotics, and stomach-satiating fats. And unlike with ultra-processed cheese or fake cheese, you usually only even need a little bit of it to feel satisfied. No, seriously, cheese can absolutely be part of a healthy diet, says Kelsey Kunick, RDN, at Graciously Nourished, a dietetic practice. Many people believe that cheese is fattening, has too many calories, is too high in sodium, or that they should avoid it because of the lactose. But the effect of cheese on your health really comes down to the type of cheese and how much you're eating. To be clear, we're not just doing something on cheese here. We're throwing a blowout bang-up party for awesome cheeses that also happen to be pretty great for you, in moderation, of course. We're celebrating, we're savoring every single bite, as you should too. Let's get this shebang started. How to make a high-protein cheese board. Curated by our favorite cheese-fluencer, Marissa Mullen. By Olivia Lupino from Women's Health. Pro tips. Provide enough. A serving size of cheese on a cheese board per person is 3 ounces, Mullen says. That's 3 ounces total per person. Buy and serve accordingly. Simplify. Funky cut fruits look cool, but make sure it's easy enough to eat. The same goes for anything else you put on your board. I like to pre-cut my hard cheese and leave my soft cheese as whole, Mullen says. That way, if you have a huge hunk of cheddar on your board, you don't have to make your guests feel pressured to cut into it first. Avoid cracker clutter. You can put a few crackers on the board, but serve the rest separately. We're fans of high-fiber, low-sugar, but still good options, like the kinds from Simple Mills or Mary's Gone Crackers. The good stuff, number one, Parmigiano Reggiano. It has a sharp profile with satisfying crunchy crystals and is perfect to pair with some salty prosciutto or grated on a summer pasta salad, says Mullen. 30 grams of protein per 3 ounces. Number two, cottage cheese, 2%. Fresh cheese, like cottage cheese, tends to be made of 50 to 60% water, which leaves less room for dense grams of protein. However, if you mix it together with eggs or add it to a chicken salad, it acts as a creamy way to pack in a bit more grams. 12 grams of protein per 3 ounces. 3. Aged Manchego. Another sheep's milk favorite, this hard cheese comes from La Mancha region in Spain. It's buttery, firm, and slightly woolly. It makes for a great pair with sweet quince paste or savory green olives. 21 grams of protein per 3 ounces. Number four, Grana Padano. It's similar to Parmigiano Reggiano, but with a slightly milder taste and smoother consistency. It's aged to be super dense, which results in more protein content. I love this paired with some local honey for a sweet contrast. 30 grams of protein per 3 ounces. Comté. This is a favorite French cheese of mine. It's an aged, hard, Alpine-style cheese known for its nutty, complex, and slightly sweet flavor profile. 24 grams of protein per 3 ounces. 6. Pecorino Romano. A hard Italian cheese made from sheep's milk. It packs a salty punch. It's umami-rich, bold, and sharp, amazing to pair with something like sweet, like fig jam. 21 grams of protein per 3 ounces. Gruyère. Comté's Swiss cousin, Gruyère, is also aged high up in the Alps and uses fresh cow's milk. It has nutty and savory notes and makes for a delicious melting cheese on sandwiches and as fondue. 24 grams of protein per 3 ounces. Food stylist Maggie Ruggiero, Hello artist, prop stylist Sophia Eleni Pappas-Laird, and good company. Special thanks to Eataly and Murray's Cheese. You've been listening to How to Make a High Protein Cheese Board from Women's Health. That'll do it for today's Women's Hour. Thanks for joining us. My name is Kelly Pyle, and I am your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. I hope you enjoyed the stories in our program today, and will make plans to join us again next week for another entertaining collection of women's magazine articles. And don't forget, you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can stream, as well as access shows on demand, on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona apps for both Apple and Android. Have a wonderful day, and be sure to stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.